But did you know that when it snows, my eyes become large and the light that you shine can be seen?
Baby, because I compare you to a kiss from a rose on the green.
Ooh, the more I get of you, the stranger feels, yeah. Now that your rose is in bloom,
the light hits the gloom on the gray.
Because I compare you to...
You like that, Christy?
It's okay. It's a competent piece of music.
For those of you that don't know... We'll get into that in a minute. We've got a mystery guest at the moment. We've been singing Kiss from a Rose all day because Chris said that he hates that song.
I thought it was overrated.
I thought it was by death, as far as I'm concerned.
It's just tacky 90s trash. That's all it is.
Trash.
Fucking
Kiss from a Rose. It's a fucking fantastic song. Everyone wants to sing it whenever they hear it.
It's just all right.
The video,
you know,
is literally sealed dancing in front of the Batmobile. Not the Batmobile, the Bat Signal.
But this is my point, is that you like it because it's in Batman Forever.
No.
You like it independent of
no.
that.
No. Yes, I would. It's an absolute quality banger.
I think...
To a kiss from a rose. See, look, that's how magical it is. You were saying something, I just sung in hushed tones a little bit of Kiss from a Rose and it stopped you in your tracks.
I mean, that's just called interrupting.
You were caught
that's
up.
What that is.
You were caught up in the magic of Seal. Anyway, this is the Full Fat Podcast, where every week we talk about Kiss from a Rose, and joining us this week is a fellow Seal enthusiast and also proud podcast owner, Mr. Charlie Lilly.
Hello there.
How are you doing?
I'm magic, mate. I'm magic as
You're
always.
You're magic?
I knew you wanted to hear
Fantastic.
It.
Fantastic. So, for those of you that don't know, Charlie runs a podcast called Your Favourite Film is Awful, where he and his co-host Luke... am I getting his name right? It's Luke.
Yes.
How do you pronounce that? Sorry,
Luke.
Got you.
Yeah, like Lou, as in like Lou roll.
K,
as in K, and then Ook.
But it's got an E on the end, so wouldn't
that
be
Luke?
Yeah, no, it's like it's got an E on the end. So is that E silent or?
Hmm?
It's just got an E on the end. So
Chris, this isn't a funny bit. Can we just drop it?
Yeah, sure.
God, yeah. Leave the comedy to me, eh? yeah, where was I? Oh yeah.
What's amazing about this right now is Matt's mugging off Chris whilst wearing sunglasses indoors. This is brilliant.
Well, I just thought I'd put them on because it gives me more confidence. Also, I find getting lost in your eyes is a constant problem. Oh. Yeah, not you, Chris.
Why were you? I'd back that because you're looking away from me as you're talking. And have been since the podcast started, so it makes sense, you know.
Oh, well, you know, I'm gonna take them off. I'm gonna now from now on when I confront both of you, I'm gonna look deeply into your eyes. So yeah, Charlie runs the Full Fat Podcast. No, he doesn't.
See, actually, I will.
I should have lost in your eyes there. Yeah. Yeah. So your favourite film is Awful. Do you want to tell us a bit about it and what you do?
Yes, so basically, it's a podcast where each week we invite guests on to defend their favourite film against negative reviews. So basically, we get people on, they say what their favourite film is, and read them out negative reviews, and we help them out essentially defend against. These you've been on there multiple times, haven't you?
I have. We did.
So has Chris, actually.
I've only been on there once.
Oh yeah.
But you know, in spirit. In spirit.
you're always with us.
We did Avengers Endgame, didn't we? Spider-Man 2, and then Chris, you did Monsters, Inc.
Monsters, Inc., yeah, we did indeed. Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. I'll definitely go on again.
Oh, yeah.
Well, actually, we did want to do Bad Boys for Life, didn't we? And then I got ill.
We did.
Yeah. It was a few weeks ago now, wasn't it? Yeah.
We did.
Another time.
We'll figure it out. We'll do it when this, you know, Bad Boys Forever comes out.
Is that the full form?
Yeah.
Has it got Bad four, has it got four
it.
In the title?
That's what I'm hoping.
Okay, that'd be great.
So I don't really think it needs that.
You know? I do. I think it's just classier.
Bad Boys Forever.
No, but I'm not saying... No, exactly. It's classier to not have it, so I think it's really obnoxious to have four ever.
But it's... Bad Boys, you know, it's a proper drama. It's not like Fast and Furious, you know, where I'd allow that sort of stuff. I would just want Bad Boys Forever.
It just, I don't know, I just...
It's a proper drama directed by Michael Bay.
There's an episode of 30 Rock where he's in a film that he keeps calling Five Now Dog Five, which is just Snow Dogs, but with like... but it's the fifth one in the franchise, so like S's. And ever since then, anytime there's like a four or a three or anything in a title, I'm just like... Have a nice little warm glow inside.
Can I just ask, why have you got the... mic to your right hand side and then you're like talking like a bit like Little Nicky?
Because if I literally move this an inch, yeah. This yep, it's fallen down.
Oh,
it's literally I don't it's
but why are you like huddled around it.
So I can keep monitoring the audio levels on the podcast as we go, as I normally do.
Is there a way that we can angle it so you can do both?
Not really at the moment, so that's why I keep looking away.
I ask because you look uncomfortable.
No, I'm always uncomfortable, you know me. When am I ever comfortable? I'm like this generation's Mark Corrigan.
And I'm this generation's Johnson, obviously.
I know, you're thinking of Johnson being a slang for a penis. That's what you're thinking.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Not Alan Johnson.
I can confirm I am a penis. you like that one, did you?
Yeah, I've heard you have one as well.
No, completely not true.
Oh, really?
No, yeah. So, yeah. I'm a eunuch.
Those cool fat rumours.
I've actually got two. It splits off into two, and then the second one transforms into a gun that the other one holds, like Megatron.
Oh, right.
Yeah, yeah. Bit weird, isn't it, that Megatron, the leader of the Decepticons, doesn't turn into something awesome. He turns into a gun that someone else then fires. What a weird design choice.
Yeah, you've got to admit, though, that's very distinctive and kind of awesome. Is Optimus Prime a truck?
No, but wouldn't it make more sense if, like, Starscream, his, like, second-in-command, turned into the gun that he fired? Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like there was a board meeting, right? There was a development meeting where this, like, plucky intern who's full of good ideas was like, I think one of the Decepticons should turn into the gun for the leader Decepticon. And then the boss that just wasn't listening was like, yeah, 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 and I think it should be Megatron that turns into the gun. And then the intern was like, no, that doesn't actually make any sense. Yes, fantastic, let's do it.
I could buy that.
Don't you think that's what happened?
Probably.
Do you just think it's weird that, like, because how do I put this? Would it not be... I hate saying would it not be better, but it's always confused me why Optimus Prime and Megatron aren't like two things that are like diametrically opposed. Because normally like transform based things, like, you know, like say it's a show about werewolves, the main villain's like, you know, like a vampire or something. Like, it's weird that like it's a truck versus a gun. Like, there's like no, like, if you break it down, like, it's not like it's like it's a submarine versus like a ship or something, is it?
What do you think would win in a fight, a truck or a gun?
Well, a truck, it'd just run it over.
I'm not if the gun's firing.
It's probably what the Decepticons were probably like.
No, the gun's the size of the truck, you know? It's going to let off a big blast.
I guess we should really ponder, are both of them being controlled by a user each? Because otherwise it's going to be a stalemate, isn't it? If the car's not moving, and if the truck's not moving and the gun's not moving.
So are you saying, are you adding realism to Transformers? By I transform into a truck.
Oh,
Optimus Prime, quickly, drive!
Are you saying it's Optimus Prime v Megatron? Because I mean literally a truck versus a gun.
I was thinking like Optimus Prime v Megatron, but I was envisioning this super realistic Transformers where Optimus Prime transforms into a truck. Oh. And then he's like, quickly, someone drive me, or like, you know, I'm just out of operation.
If it was Optimus Prime v anyone, he'd win. Because in the films, he's always the one that's like tearing through the Decepticons like butter.
Because, again, because he's giant and he turns into a truck versus the guy who turns into a gun. Like, it's really obvious that, like...
Charlie, was it you a few years ago? It might have been one of your younger brothers or maybe, like, a cousin or something. But I distinctly remember you saying to me that, like, someone in your family said that Transformers was better than Star Wars. And the reason they cited as to why was because... Optimus Prime was much bigger and more powerful than Darth Vader, and he could crush him.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that?
No.
I remember that being like, amazing. That's a load of bullshit.
That's a load of bollocks, to be fair.
Darth Vader would beat Optimus Prime, wouldn't he?
He'd fuck him up, mate.
He'd crush him, wouldn't he?
The Force.
Yeah. The Force.
What do you think Darth Vader's Transformer power would be? Do you think he'd transform into a Death Star?
They did actually do. You joke, they did Star Wars Transformers,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, I think that. He probably did. He might have transformed into like a TIE fighter.
That's actually pretty sick. I'd watch that. Cool. What was Palpy's transform?
To a legend?
I don't know. But the thing with his power is like he can just come back from the dead like again and again and again.
Oh, yeah.
Somehow.
He can transform into a bankable ninth movie.
Bankable, you say?
Yeah. Which is probably the last time your fans actually heard me, to be fair, was us shitting on the
So you've been on the... when we broke down sort of our initial reactions to Skulker. And then you might be heard in the background of some Look Who's Talkings.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, so he's always been there in the shadows. Somehow, Charlie Lilly has returned.
I'm back.
Do you think they'll do an episode 10?
Yes, 100%. I think it's like an inevitability.
Do you think it'll have Palpy in, though?
Because well,
We haven't actually spoken about this, I didn't realise.
How to put this, because obviously their creative logic behind bringing him back is, quote, it's not Star Wars unless it's got Palpatine. So does that mean episode 10, 11 and 12 will have to have some Palpatine-esque
involvement? But I mean, I don't really take anything Chris Terrio says seriously from his sandbox playing with his toys, you know? Like, I mean, I think it's nap time, isn't it, really?
I mean, that's funny
nap
you say that.
Nap time now, Terrio.
It's funny you say that, because the best review of Batman v Superman I've ever read was from The Guardian, where they said, the cinematic equivalent of a five-year-old putting two dolls together and mashing them.
Oh, yeah, I see that.
And it's like, that is actually what that film
it's
is.
Quite accurate, fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, I think there will be an episode 10. I think it'll be Boyega, Ridley, maybe even Oscar Isaac will be coming back. I think they'd be idiots not to try and bring Adam Driver back into the fold. I'm not saying they should or that any of those things would be good, because I think they've done enough damage at this point, but I think it will happen.
The thing is that's unfortunate with all this stuff is you say, oh, you know, I'd be very disenchanted. Like, we would end up seeing episode 10, wouldn't we? That's the huge,
yeah,
like,
but you
almost...
know, I do give a free pass there, because I think there's a certain tier of fans that, you know, there's a certain like base level of an audience that will go and see everything no matter whether it's good or bad, because you're just an aficionado of that kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're sci-fi fans, you're going to see all these new Star Wars movies and all these kind of things. Like, it doesn't mean that... I don't think you should feel bad about going to see them.
No, I'm not saying...
Even if you think they're going to be bad, like, you know...
It's a curiosity thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not saying you're a hypocrite. I just think it's an unfortunate consequence, because I think we'd be where we're at. And then you'd be foolish not to go and see it, because it could be good. Because, The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi were good. But it's almost sad, isn't it? Because it really does show that to some degree, you don't have to try that much. Which I think is what Rise of Skywalker is a product of. It is a product of committee thinking. And I think the fact that it didn't, like, bomb is a testament to the fact that, like, people will come back. I mean, let's face it, like, rationally... I mean, as it turns out, they've been on an upward curve. But rationally, after Batman v Superman, the 1-2 punch of BVS and Suicide Squad, you'd have good logic to not go and see another DCU film, wouldn't you?
I suppose, but I did want to see... Yeah, no, that's the thing. But also, like, that base level of fandom doesn't mean a film will become a hit. You know, like, it's about getting general audiences. So I don't feel like I'm contributing to them making these movies, continuing to make them bad. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh,
I was going to see it anyway, and so were that fan base.
I agree. I just think it's like a... It's just like it's a sad reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
To some degree, they know that they'll get a certain bank on huge franchises. In the same way that Spectre made loads of money. And it's, you know...
Oh, yeah, like, James Bond, they could shit out whatever they wanted at this point. Everyone will go and see it. Your dad will go and see it. Well, I mean, I don't know, maybe my dad goes to see it. but, yeah, so... On that note, it stumped me when you said that Last Jedi and Force Awakens were good, because I actually think now, retroactively, I'm disliking Force Awakens more and more and more.
Really?
Now that we've seen the whole trilogy come together... and just kind of looking back on it as a whole, I mean, even as a movie itself, like, Charlie, we did the marathon, didn't we, before Rise of Skywalker came out. I remember when we got to Force Awakens, I was like quite amped. We'd gotten through 6 episodes at that point. It was a really fun time. And then rewatching Awakens, I think now that we've removed it from that hype of when it came out, I was just kind of like, I'm a bit bored, honestly. And then on top of that, the way they egg on all those mystery boxes. Like, you know, you've got Rey going like, oh, you know, big secret who my parents are to BB-8. Like, oh, you know, we'll find out one day. And it's like, that's directly addressing the audience and saying, you should be thinking about this for the next 2 years. You should become obsessed with this. This is the pertinent question. Who are my parents? So, you know, like, it's strange. Like, I think it's wrong to get obsessed with who her parents are after they've answered it in Last Jedi. But at the same time, I do kind of sympathise as to why people got obsessed with that question, because when you go back and watch Force Awakens, they egg it on so much, they lay it on so thick, and it ends up being something that doesn't matter.
I mean, we didn't mind back then because it was, you know, we didn't know what the answers were, but now knowing, you know, how it ended up being, it's weird going back and watching it. And it's weird because I think when we were watching it and we went through that watch, we realised that some of the stuff that we love so much about it, I think we're in... The Last Jedi. I think we forgot how much The Last Jedi actually does bring to the world of that new Star Wars saga. And every time I was watching it, I was just kind of like waiting for The Last Jedi.
Poe's not a character in Force Awakens, is he? His one trait is that he's awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, no matter what situation he's in, he's got a quip for everything.
But
like,
I think
he's so wafer thin. And then in Last Jedi, they actually sort of deconstruct that kind of gung-ho bullshit. And, you know, he realises he can't just send the bombers in, because everyone's going to die. Yeah.
I think what it does do, though, really successfully, is it does introduce you to, other than Poe Dameron, I thought it was strange how, I mean, when you actually look at it, Poe Dameron and Finn kind of switch importance.
Well, you know, originally Poe was going to die.
Yeah. Wasn't it just because they cast Isaac and they were like, it's a bit of a waste?
Well, he was like, oh no, please let me live.
But did you not see in the interviews?
What, are you talking about, like, recently he was like, they should let me die? Yeah.
But I feel...
It's hard to tell with that stuff, just like whether they're joking or whether they actually hate the movie.
But I feel like a good thing it does really well is it sets up that world... And you do kind of accept those characters as Star Wars characters, and you did from 2015. And I don't necessarily think... I think that's a hard thing to do in an established universe. And I think as you say, like, it's a bit like Doctor Who Series 12, isn't it? As much as a lot of the central mysteries that it sets up don't ultimately pay off, I think as a solo individual film, it's fun. Like, it's nothing like Rise of Skywalker.
It is fun, but
like,
it's so devoid of imagination. And like I do agree with Chris, worse. Though, it gets worse with age.
Yeah.
You know?
I do agree with Chris, though, that... In the job it did in terms of setting up these characters, I mean, we were like, you know, they did feel like Star Wars characters already. So I do agree with that. It's just how they ended up, you know, and what they ended up being. But
I do think a fundamental issue with this, and yes, the original trilogy had this, but there's a lot of baton passing in terms of the directing, right? Mm. And like, it does, JJ, there was no overarching vision for it. Really, and that's really abundantly apparent, because The Last Jedi just sticks out like a subtle thumb tonally, and it is very clear that like almost everyone was given too much autonomy who did it individually, and now like JJ had so much autonomy in Rise of Skywalker, he just retconned the thing that Rian Johnson did, and Rian Johnson in turn had such autonomy in Last Jedi that it feels so disjointed. Whereas I feel like, I mean, it's such a cliche, but I feel like at least the original trilogy, whilst it wasn't all directed by Lucas, it had a sort of a unified vision of the story it's trying to tell. And I think it's so apparent that the if you actually were to say to someone and they hadn't seen it, and we did this in our video on Palpatine, if you describe the plot of the prequels, that it's a good plot. It's just the execution that's sort of candid.
Whereas the sequel trilogy is all over the place from the get-go, isn't it?
Yeah, like, if you beat sheet that story across three movies, it is a terrible story. It makes no sense.
It's so clear they didn't have a plan. But that's kind of why, again, it annoys me about Force Awakens, is those questions which ended up plaguing the fan base and causing all those divides come from Force Awakens, and they come from specifically Abrams having this obsession with creating mystery over story, creating his mystery boxes. He didn't have an answer for those things then. And then... when he was forced to come up with an ending and come up with those answers, the answers were terrible. So he forced, not just Rian Johnson, not just Colin Trevorrow, whoever ended up in those driving seats in 2 and 3 were going to be lumped with a shit mystery box, which had no satisfying answer.
But also, it's like that, you know, Hitchcock thing where he says that, you know, the mystery is never as, you know, it's never going to be, the answer that you wanted. The answer's never going to be as interesting as you... As the audience has already put in their minds, So that's why he was not a massive fan of like whodunits.
But that was why JoJo did it, didn't he? Because at that point he didn't have to come back for 2 or 3. So it's kind of crafty what he's doing. He's just setting up those mystery boxes and going, oh, someone else will deal with it.
No, it is literally that.
You know, it's lazy.
I'd agree with that. I was going to say, like, I actually don't think Rise of Skywalker... Like, we wouldn't have got The Last Jedi, which I think is a phenomenal film, but would Rise of Skywalker necessarily have been bad had JJ directed all three? We would have got a bland, uninspired trilogy. I'm not saying, you know, I'll take the trade-off for The Last Jedi having exists, but at least then he would have himself had to have answered those questions. And I think so much of the issue is that JJ in his head has gone, no, those weren't the right answers, and then it's just given us some crappy expositional. Although I do think The Last Jedi probably would have ended up like Star Trek Into Darkness, as in, I have no idea what I've done. So it would have probably been like, and then Darth Vader came back, or something really fan-pleasing to just... You know what I mean? Or Snoke would have mutated into Palpy in The Last Jedi.
I don't think that's the main issue. I think maybe the plan thing, maybe that would have helped if they had a plan. But I also do think the fact that they did one director, another director for the second one, and then brought the first director back for the third one is an issue because no matter who that director is, they're going to try and tell the story they originally had in their mind anyway. So I think that they needed to have a third different director. And I think that would have been different because he would have had to have solved the puzzles that were left by Ryan necessarily.
Well, it's like what we were saying the other day, wasn't it? Like about Duel of the Fates, the Colin Trevorrow version, the Hotel Drago version, is in concept, it's already better than Rise of Skywalker. It doesn't matter if the dialogue had been prequel tier. Like, the fact that it pushes those characters forward, it doesn't retcon anything, doesn't go back on any of the themes of the last movie, keeps Rey a nobody, and that's the fucking point of the story.
Yeah.
Has Finn overthrowing, you know, the oppression of the stormtroopers. Like, that was where those characters were meant to be going. Yes. So, to me, it doesn't matter if it come across in a ham-fisted way, like,
or been a bad movie, it still tried to tell the right story.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's literally what you were saying a moment ago, Chris, about like the prequels. Like, you know, to me, the Duel of the Fates script that, you know, never came to be is a good concept, maybe kind of shoddily executed. But that's better than 2.5 hours of corporate package retconning. It's Disney reaching out collectively and going, we know some of you like The Last Jedi and some of you hated The Last Jedi. Don't worry. We're going to make this as vanilla as possible. No risks going to be taken. Nothing's going to, you know, get doubled down on. We're just going to give you like the most lightest, fluffiest way possible so that you can all like it and then we can all make money.
And I'll say this as well. I understand there's less context for why they played it that safe, I think, than I understand why Force Awakens was safe.
Yes.
Because it had to be in a way, because if people had gone, it's like the prequels, people would have just not turned up. So yeah, I get doing a safe film and then doing a risky second film. There should have been a risky third film. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, yeah. And like this sort of sanitized. It's that same thing we often say about Doctor Who. Like, me and you, I mean, you give series 6 of Doctor Who a lot more kind of credence than I do. For those of you who've not seen it, I mean, most people here are Doctor Who fans, but say they're not. It's the one where it's probably the most arc-heavy series of Doctor Who ever. Mm. It tries to tell one continuous story. And I think it has quite a lot of cack-handed execution. I think there's a lot of problems.
It can buckle under the weight of its ambitions.
Yeah, and its finale is an absolute mess. But I would take 100 iterations of Series 6 than the corporate, sanitized thing that we got in Jodie Whittaker's first season. I'd take 100 of them. I'd take 100 noble failures in any franchise over films that just do not have any imagination or any kind of thought process behind them.
I completely agree.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's it at the end of the day. It's that, like, I'm always...
At the end of the day. At the end of the sodding day.
You know what I mean? I'm willing to give a lot more films free passes if I go, oh, well, you know, it's a bit like why you love Aquaman so much, right? There are things that might not work, but it's trying to be all these things all at once.
Yes. And I think there's something to be said for... I mean, it's like we were saying earlier about Seal, you know. There's nothing wrong with campy and cheesy. It depends if that... Is that the point of the film?
Exactly.
Like, there's no way James Wan didn't know how ridiculous Aquaman is. Like, that is the point of the film. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
And I think he did a good job in terms of Aquaman is usually the joke, isn't he? At the Justice League. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of, like, in popular culture, Aquaman's always known as, like, the lame one. Mm. So to make him this OTT powerhouse is actually quite funny.
But it's just so creative. Like, it goes to so many different places. And I think, like you were saying earlier about the problem with the, you know, The Force Awakens is that, you know, it has so many ideas of, you know, with the planets and the ships, the way they look like sharks and, like, you know what I mean? There's so much creativity and fun. And yeah, it's aware how sort of silly it is at times, but that's what I love about it because it can totally embraces it. There's no pretense to it. It is what it is. Do you know what I mean?
Any film that has the balls to give us a drumming octopus that is in fact based on a Silver Age sidekick from the comics and the 80s sports montage of Black Manta building his suit, you know, that is a movie that knows what it is. And
surfing
I love that.
Crocodiles.
Yeah,
with lasers. With sharks with freaking laser beams
attached to their heads. Literally. $1 million. Yeah. So should we go through what we saw this week, guys?
Yeah,
should we perhaps start with what me and Charlie watched last night to put the fear of God in us?
We could.
We watched Contagion. I don't know if you're listening to this a year later or whatever, but obviously, you know, we're living in the UK. Many people have been asked to work from home because of COVID-19, coronavirus. Mm. And I just keep seeing on Twitter everywhere people going back to this movie Contagion, aren't they? Because of how chillingly true to life some of it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you seen it, Chris?
No, but I will tell you this. I believe on Netflix at the moment, it's like top trending of the week.
Really?
And it's it's become like one of the most watched films this week, just like because of how much of a renewed interest there is in it.
Really?
Well, it was suggested on Amazon Prime when we watched it. It came up straight away on the first front page, and it's like it's not really a movie that's in the zeitgeist anyway, and it's only because of this like that now.
It's been watched by like everyone left, right, and centre. Like
Soderbergh's having a fucking way. Like he's like I'm benefiting a lot of it.
I'm sure he is. Yeah.
So what did you? What is it? A good movie?
I thought it was fantastic. I thought some of the character work in it was really strong. And also now that we're in the midst of this pandemic, the way that it tracks how the virus spreads is really, really well done. And also I looked up some factoids afterwards after we watched it. And many members of the scientific community feel it's like one of the most scientifically accurate films of all time.
But I felt that through watching it, and I don't know anything about, but I could believe that totally. Yeah. Like it's just the way Soderbergh shoots it as well. Like there's so many awkward angles that are left a little bit of a distance that make you feel so uneasy.
It doesn't feel like a movie, does it? It feels like a documentary at times.
Yeah. Yeah. And he'll cut to like close-ups of people touching things and like picking up mugs. And it won't even be necessarily connected to the story, but like it makes your skin crawl.
It makes you not want to touch anything.
Yep, yep.
And you also realise, as we're sort of, well, not starting to realise, but are realising once again, as a collective, how easy it is for this stuff to spread.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, we live in a city that's populated by how many?
London. Let's say this: it outstrips most. Like, you could take a large county in the UK, and London alone as a city will outstrip it. Like,
isn't there more people in London than in Australia?
I wouldn't know. I know there's a lot more people in London than quite a lot of countries.
Well, at least 100% of all internet facts are made up, aren't they? So maybe that's not accurate. But you know, like. If the virus in the movie was real, it would play out exactly like that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, horrifying.
But again, like it's not just about watching it spread and the tension of like are they gonna find a vaccine for this? The character work is really strong. Yeah. I mean, I think we're gonna go into spoilers with it. So Chris, the movie starts off right, and Gwyneth Paltrow's just on the phone to some guy, and he's like he references that they had sex the night before. And then you don't know who she is. She comes home to Matt Damon, and then it becomes clear that that's her husband. So he doesn't know, obviously, she's been playing away, but she's also like, she's got a bit of a red nose and all that. And then she starts having a seizure, like in the kitchen. Oh, and he's like, oh my fucking God, yeah.
It's horrifying as well.
It's really, really chilling. No, and like his son, his stepson, her son, sees his mum having a seizure, and it's shot from an angle of what the kid would be seeing. And it's kind of like he's looking through kind of like the kitchen
cabinets.
Yeah, and he can just see her sort of like fidgeting. It's horrible. Anyway. He takes her to the hospital. This is all like rapid fire pacing, and she just dies. And there's this awesome scene where it feels so true to life. It feels like how you would react.
Yep.
The doctors just go up to him and they're like, she's passed away. And he's kind of like just asking questions, and he just freaks out. He's like, what are you talking about? Do you know what I mean? Like,
he's like, I see her like a minute ago. Yeah. Like, I was with her a minute ago.
Yeah, she was absolutely fine. Yeah. And then she just died. And then it sort of traces back to her night before she came back, because she was on a visit for work, and you see how she sort of infected all these other people, and then he's being isolated, Matt Damon, and they're asking him all these questions about how she might have got it or where she was, and then he suddenly pieces together like, wait, why was she in Chicago? And then they're like, they won't answer, and he's like, she knew a man called John Neal. She had a relationship with him before she met me, and he was in Chicago. And then they pause. The woman talking to him doesn't say anything. And then he's like, does John Neal have the same virus? I.e., if he has it and she has it, he knows they were sleeping together.
See,
and
then she's just dead as well.
Yeah. Like, after she's died. Yeah. So it's such a difficult process of mourning for him, because obviously he lost his wife. Oh, the stepson, he comes back. The stepson's just dead in his bed. So he's caught it.
So after he's asked all the questions, he's found that she's cheating and that she's dead. He comes running home and realizes the fucking stepson's caught it and died. Yeah.
That's a great setup.
No, oh. it was amazing.
This, I think, the best scene in the movie. I think you'll probably agree with me. Yep. So Kate Winslet, is she? I think she's playing someone at the World Health Organization,
yes,
isn't she?
Or
it might be just America. She's playing someone who's sort of been tasked with researching the spread of the virus.
Yeah.
And
helping others.
Yeah. And she's trying to sort of work out what, you know, how it's been contacted, right? And then she's in a hotel room while she's in the midst of her research, and she realizes she got it. And she's looking in the mirror, and she starts going like, no, 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 no. Because you know there's no cure for it, and it takes about 4 days, and then you just drop dead. So she knows.
She knows more than anyone.
It's a ticking clock. And she tells Larry Fishburne, who's on the other side of the phone, and obviously he knows that's it. But he's going on the other side like, oh, don't worry, it'll be fine. I'll get you out there, right? As it's cutting to all these different storylines, all these different people sort of
dealing with the
virus in different ways. So it's cutting back and forth, all these different storylines, right? We cut back to Kate Winslet, and obviously, like, it's progressed. She's laying in this bed in like a big gym where, like, they've got loads and loads of patients, and she's delirious, right? And she looks across, and there's this guy in another bed next to her, right? And they've sort of set up at this point, she's a good person. She really cares about containing this virus and helping people, right? He's going like, I'm cold to this nun who's helping people. And she's like, there's no more blankets. And he's like, I'm cold. And then she walks off, right? And then you just see from a wide shot, Kate Winslet, as she's like dying, she's been trying to give up her own blanket and give it to the guy, but she can't reach because she's obviously like dying. And then the next cut, she's fucking dead in a ditch.
She's being buried, yeah.
Yeah. And then that's just it. That's her storyline.
Oh my lord.
Yeah, yeah, no, so it's really good.
And obviously, like, you're like, no one will ever know that even at the end, she was trying to give this guy her blanket. And he won't know, she won't know, the nun won't know.
Well, he'll have died too, won't he?
Yeah.
So do they stop it?
Yeah, so they end up formulating a vaccine. None of it's done in like a Hollywood, like, we've got to get the vaccine. You know what I mean? It's told over a period of like 100 or something days. And then eventually they do get a vaccine, but it kills like, is it like 1% of the population or something like that? Really, but like, it's massive. And there's all these kind of like interesting ways different people deal with it. Like, so for example, Jude Law is playing like a journalist, right? And it's set when like bloggers are still kind of like a novelty in Hollywood movies. So he's got this blog called like Truth Serum or whatever, and he's got like 12 million viewers or whatever, and they keep going like, oh yeah, you're a blogging journalist.
Do you remember that beautiful period in movies where like everyone would always have like a random conspiracy blog in like any kind of blog? I saw like Russell T Davies in Doctor Who used that like 24/7, and I feel like now they're doing that with vloggers.
It's exactly that tone,
right? I know exactly what I know, like literally pound for pound what character you're talking about to a T.
So basically at one point he gets sick. And then there's this drug called like Forsythia, is that correct?
Forsythia, yeah.
Forsythia. And he says that he used it and then he got cured again. So then he starts going in front of like WHO and saying, you know, you guys aren't promoting this drug, you're trying to bury it because you want to make profits off these drugs and blah, 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 blah. And then they then turn around and go to him, well, it seems like you've made almost $4 million off of promoting this drug. So it seems like we've tested your blood. Doesn't seem like you were ever sick at all. Seems like you said to your followers, oh yeah, this drug will be the cure, and they had you in their back pocket. But you never get any of those answers confirmed.
Yeah, nice.
And his retort to that is, well, of course you'd say my blood work is fine, I never got the virus. But you do see him with like a red nose and stuff talking online and like a stream. But of course, did he fake the red nose? So like, was he actually trying to profit from it? Like, or did he genuinely believe that cured him? Like, did he even have it? Like, it's really interesting.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And it's really good because like, even after like they've found a vaccine, you're like, oh, okay, the movie must be done now. And then it's like, no, how the fuck are we going to get this vaccine out to all these people? Because all these people are like waiting in line to do it. How can we do it in the most way, the best way possible without everyone killing each other for this vaccine, essentially. Yeah. So like, there's stuff like people are being kidnapped, like all around, like scientists and that, all around the world, but like certain people to sort of hold them ransom for the vaccine and stuff like that.
Like Marion Cotillard. Yeah. She gets held hostage, right, by this like small village in China. And she gets to know them. And like, obviously she cares about all the kids and stuff, like actually wants them to get the vaccine. And then they have a drop off where the Chinese government have agreed to give them so many vaccinations in exchange for Marion Cotillard. So they do the drop off, right? And then the last time you see her in her final scene, she's at the airport waiting to go home, like when it's all dying down. And the guy that picked her up like in the ransom exchange, just like, oh yeah, they were all placebos that we gave them. Like, we can't negotiate with terrorists. So all those kids are going to like keel over and die. And she just runs out of the airport.
That's the last time you see her.
So you never even know if she fixed it or whatever.
Oh my God.
No, it's really... Do you know what? It was one of those things where I was watching it. I was like, I don't know if this is really good because of the current situation that we're in, or if this is actually just a really good movie that people have sort of overlooked a little bit. I think
it is the latter because obviously there is a potency to people watching it now. Obviously, there's a lot of hysteria and fear. I mean, if we go down to our local Asda, isn't it, Chris?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean,
the
like...
The aisles are picked clean at the moment. Yeah. It's crazy.
And people are just like people are... It's weird because it's bringing out the best and the worst in people because as many as there are people like knocking on doors saying, I can get you supplies, etc. There are also people who you're at the supermarket and they're literally trying to push you physically out of the way just to get to a random piece of, and you know,
I think it's worth saying to anyone listening, if it makes you anxious listening to this, that the virus in the movie is portrayed as a million times worse than what we're dealing with. You know, this is something that is affecting immunocompromised people, people over 70. You know, people in our age bracket. The danger is more being carriers, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think as well, like, of course it has to be more Hollywood and things like that.
Yeah.
You know what it weirdly reminds
me of?
So
don't think that Kate Winslet's going to die. Basically, is what I'm saying.
What it's weirdly reminding me of when you're talking about it is, when was the last time you saw Dawn of the Planet of the Apes? Do you remember the beginning of that?
And yes, that is about a virus as well.
And the way that
it
keeps spreading, and the way that's like scientists ignore it and just think of it as a novelty, almost like you would think of like a new virus in a Petri dish, but they're looking at the ape like, oh, this would be
fun.
Is
that the first one, the James Franco one?
Yes.
I believe that's, isn't that Rise? And then the second one's Dawn and the third one's War?
You're right. You're right. Yeah. Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I got that wrong. Dawn is the one that I really like. That's
Dawn is when it's spreading though, and they're all a bit ill, aren't they still?
Yeah, and Dawn is the one with Cobra, and it's
Gary
that kind
Oldman's
of it's that Hamlet-esque disagreement where they both disagree about the best future for the kingdom and stuff like that.
They're all pretty decent to be
fair. I think the third one was incredible. I remember seeing it in the cinema, and like me and the person I saw it with at the time, we were both sort of like tearing up.
Yeah.
And
I was surprised how good that one was. I quite enjoyed that.
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic.
It's some of the best mocap acting, I think. I think it's got some of the best mocap acting, period.
Mm. And I think Rise is brilliant.
The fact that it makes you sort of, because, you know, in the movies, you're watching these apes literally decimate human populations. Mm. And, like, you know, they spread an infectious virus to humans and they're, like, beating the crap out of people. And the fact it actually gets you to sort of think there is no good or bad side in this war is quite affecting when it's literally, like, what is effectively aliens versus humans, isn't it? And you want to naturally sympathise with the humans, but it's quite nice to see it done with Planet of the Apes.
What I also really like about it is, you know, when you have a sequel to something and they couldn't get the lead from the first one back, and it's really obvious that they're trying to work around it. I remember when the sequel, the trailer for Dawn came out, I was like, oh, they obviously couldn't get James Franco back. Now they've got Jason Clarke, lame. But by the time you come around to the third one, you see it all. It's actually, no. The human characters that come in and out of each film are the antagonists. This is about the CGI chimps, isn't it? Like, they're the ones that actually are the characters that go through the whole trilogy, and they're the protagonists.
Yeah. It's really funny you say that, because have you seen Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which is the sequel to the original Planet of the Apes?
I have not, no.
So that involves another astronaut crashing on the ape planet looking for Charlton Heston. Oh, and the whole film, Charlton Heston isn't there, and he's only in like the final like 15 minutes.
What happens?
Basically,
full spoilers for Beneath the Planet. Yes. Yeah.
It's actually quite cool. So I say quite cool. Like, I think it's quite a novel way to do it. So
I've heard some of the sequels are good.
Yeah, Dr. Zaius, I think, is still in it. And like, I'm working off memory here, so don't, you know, if some of this is slightly wrong, I apologise. But from my memory, Dr. Zaius is still in it, and they're still sort of like, oh, I remember when Charlton Heston, and he like disappeared into this like forbidden zone.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, obviously they go to the forbidden zone, and the last vestiges of humanity are actually like hidden in this like underground cave, and they've all developed super intelligence, but they're like hidden themselves from, like, I think they've got mind control powers, but I'm not 100% on that. So they've like hidden themselves, like they've mutated because like nuclear fallout, but they all worship a giant nuclear bomb.
That's cool.
They all worship it. It's like a god, because that's the thing that brought the first Armageddon, and they've got the last nuclear bomb, and they're like obsessed with it. And then Charlton Heston's character has been like, I think he's been prisoned down there. And so that's when you meet up with him at the end. So these are the only like original intelligent humans, and not the sort of the feral humans that you see in the first Planet of the Apes. And at the end, just like the first one, it's got this very like, you know, last 2 minutes, the apes raid it and someone accidentally falls on and launches off the nuclear bomb. And I'm pretty sure the narration is like, do you know what planet that was? It was Earth, kind of like stupid, cheesy ending.
Right.
But I think it's quite a novel way to do it, is that humanity did survive and it's obsessed with nuclear bombs.
That sounds like quite an interesting way to take it.
It's a mess.
That's the first sequel.
Yeah, it's a mess, but I think some of the concepts that are in it, I think making them super intelligent is cool. I think making them have powers is dumb. Because why don't they just come out of the underground cave and just like float the, you know, just like...
Do you think they learn to stop worrying and love the bomb?
Oh,
and on that note,
but I have actually heard that some of the sequels for the Planet of the Apes, sorry to butt in, are actually quite good. I've heard Conquest of the Planet of the Apes is really good, and it's been on my list for years, and I still haven't watched it.
I love that the titles are always so long winded.
Yeah.
It's not like Rise of the Apes; it's Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, because isn't one of them like Journey to the Center of the Planet of the Apes or something like utterly?
I think
ridiculous.
It might be something like that.
I think
it's
something like
fantastic.
I know the sequel's called fantastic. Beneath. But like, it's so bizarre that they spawned a
above
massive
the Planet of the Apes, to the side of the Planet of the Apes. the moon of the planet of the apes.
Have you seen the have you seen the 2001 Tim Burton one?
Yes, yes, I have. It's fucking terrible. Trash. Yeah.
Is it actually that bad? I've never
awful.
Seen it.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it's really
with
bad.
Mark Wahlberg in it.
Marky Mark.
Yeah. I remember when I was a kid.
Marky
it was
Mark
one of those
and
movies.
The Furry Bunch.
But do you remember that was
brilliant?
That was like a tentpole movie that kids were seeing and stuff when I was like 6 or 7. A bit like, do you remember when everyone went and saw War of the Worlds? Which is quite
yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Well, like when King Kong came out and everyone saw it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
None of those movies were that good. I just thought it was in that category. I didn't realise it was awful.
It was back when you got like,
but they're not as
weird
bad
blockbusters.
Yeah.
Like,
I've got a lot of time for the Peter Jackson King Kong.
I'll say,
once they actually get to
and War of the Worlds. And War of the Worlds.
Once they get to the eight, that film, the first hour of that movie, where you there's so many story threads in that don't go anywhere. Like they're like, he was brought in as a boy, abandoned on the ship. Dun-dun. You just never get any resolution
it's
on anything.
Only allowed to be that long because he made Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
well. That's what's crazy about it. Like yeah. any other time period right. or any other director, they would have been like, nope.
Yep, you're right. Yeah.
The ice skating scene in that film is pretty goat. I'll tell you one thing though. Have you ever played the terrible Nintendo DS tie-in game for that movie? It's like supposed to be like one of the worst games ever made. It's
really?
Like a shoot 'em up, but I think you just like tap the screen and like the graphics are like Game Boy Advance level.
That's
and it's
amazing.
Clearly like developed for the Game Boy Advance. They were quickly like, let's make it touchscreen. And like it's just broken.
That is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, War of the Worlds I will defend a lot. It's got some like, I'm not normally one of these people. And I don't think it is a testament to its quality at all, but it has got some of the best shots of Spielberg's career in it. I don't think
some
that makes
good
it a good or bad film.
Opening, I remember being really
I always remember when he, full spoilers, I always remember when he kills that guy who they're like imprisoned with in the bunker. He just like straight up murders him, doesn't he? Because he's making a lot of noise.
Oh, I don't remember.
It's been a long time since I watched
so it. So they're in this underground cabin and it's with this like, it's a bit like Cloverfield Lane type, you know, I've been planning this for years. And they're all right for a few days and then the guy starts going stir crazy who they're like sharing with. And I'm pretty sure he's doing something like, he thinks that they are like classic, like something to do with the water or irrigated, and he gets this axe and he starts like bashing it on the ground. And Tom Cruise's character is like, stop doing that. And you can hear the aliens over above, and he's like, why are you doing that? And he's like, I'm stopping them from getting to me. And then you just hear off screen Tom Cruise straight up murdering this guy, like just murdering him to show him up.
Really?
Yeah, and then he just comes back to his daughter and he's got a bit of blood on him. It's sick.
That's awesome.
That's awesome, yeah.
Like that, it's like, that's the length he'll go for his family. It's awesome.
Well, I'm not being funny, like. If there were aliens outside and this dickhead will not stop hammering away, I'd go MC Hammer his ass.
It's gonna happen.
It's honestly that. I think that film's got some really good moments. I just think it's a bit corny in parts.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I watched it.
It's one of those films I've seen probably twice when it's been on at Christmas and seen probably like 45 minutes to like an hour and a half of it. Do you know what I mean? Like I've never seen the full thing, but I've seen a lot of it. I've seen enough of it to be like, yeah, I know what this feels like.
I think it's so lame, if you remember the ending at all, where they get beamed up and he's got a single grenade and then he like puts his hand up and all the people are like pushing him up and he just like sits there with it, willing to die, and then somehow he escapes and then they all just die abruptly afterwards. It's really weird.
Because in the original, they just wait out, don't they? And then they die of germs.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same ending, but Tom Cruise manages to make it out by literally, he has a grenade in his hand and people are like pushing him up.
So there's a bit of an action finale.
Yeah, so it's weird. Like they're kept in like pens underneath the ships and then the big iron claw comes and picks them up one by one, a bit like the claw in Toy Story, presumably to be used as like experiments of food or something. It's never really clear.
I'm actually working on a similar idea at the moment. It's a spec script. It's called War of the Words. And it's like poets have decided that enough is enough for people not taking their art form seriously and they invade.
How do they invade?
they invade your brains with their words.
They're genius.
Yeah. And like we have to find like the world's best rapper. Because obviously like rap's like obviously like modern poetry. And he's like, yeah, all right, I'll fight him back.
Please tell me he's played by Chet Hanks.
Chet Hanks, yeah.
Oh my God. Chet fucking Hanks.
I thought that was going to be your punchline. I was just like, when's he going to mention Chet Hanks?
I'm going to be honest. I was just going with the flow. Maybe it would have been Chet Hanks. Maybe it would have been Snoop Dogg. Like, we have no idea which rapper I would have fallen
but
on.
But you weren't tripping.
Oh, they're fine. They're not tripping. They have coronavirus. No, I love. For those of you unaware, we're talking about Chet Hanks' Instagram video where he tells the world that Tom Hanks has coronavirus. I just love the way he's like, yeah, so they got coronavirus. crazy.
Like, what?
Just shut up, Janks. If you're listening, just shut up. Just you know what? Just stop whatever you're doing. Just hole away in a fucking bunker until the world has decided we want to see you again. Honestly. And the patois, just cut it out. You sound like such a Chris, what does he sound like?
Just an awful, awful
person.
You're not
gonna
swear.
No. I swear. Have you seen him speaking patois?
Yes, I have.
Isn't it the most cringy thing you've ever seen?
Yeah. Yes. I
mean, this man has coasted on daddy's money, making terrible rap music.
Yeah.
What is he in? He's in Fanfarstick.
Yep.
And I think he's in like the Bratz movie. And we have the audacity as a society, as a community, to allow himself to call himself an actor/rapper with that resume.
He looks nothing like how you'd imagine Tom Hanks' son to be.
Colin Hanks is what you imagine.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And then
imagine.
Chet is like, I don't know where it came from.
No idea.
Well, we know it came at the end of Tom Hanks' penis, but we don't know why. You know, I don't feel bad making fun of Chet Hanks. You know.
Well, I'm pretty sure he said
some dollars, isn't he?
I'm pretty sure he said he's allowed to say the N-word.
He did say that, yeah. Have you seen the video of him justifying it?
Yeah.
He's like, well, my friends, who are black, by the way, say I can use it, so... And he's like sort of like looking like off camera, like not really like acknowledging the interviewer. Yeah. He's above them. I'm like, what an arsehole, honestly. Chet Hanks. It just annoys me, you know, that kind of... The way he presents himself and the way he puts on this like fake working class voice when he's the son of Tom fucking Hanks, you know, like have some self-awareness. No, you were born into a lot of opportunities. And also the fact that you had that much wealth and that many resources and you still managed to make, what is it called? Like Doing It Better, his Chet Hanks song, which literally, if I have just shown you out of context, you'd think was a Lonely Island song.
It does look like a Lonely Island.
That's how bad it is. Like, just fuck off. You know, like, no, just, well, you know what, just if you grow up rich, you know, that's, you can't choose where you're born, but don't pretend like you're from the street.
Yeah,
you're
no,
an embarrassment,
yeah.
mate.
No, literally. Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
You're right, Chris.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just in awe of the, I'm just in awe
the
of
Chet
the
Hanks
Chet
experience.
Hanks hate, yeah. I mean, I think he's an awful person, I'm not going to deny that. You know, it's just the intensity of that hate.
It's just the way he's like walking around, like trying to pretend that he's something he's not, you know.
Yeah.
Like you come from a lot of money.
Yeah.
You come from Tom Hanks' big penis. I was gonna say Willy, and then I was like, should I say penis? And then it came out penis.
Bloody hell!
Do you think Tom Hanks got big before Chet Hanks was made? You know what I'm talking about.
So what else have you been watching recently?
I'll be honest, I've been watching a lot of Chet Hanks videos. He's my new obsession at the moment. I can't, he's such a paradox, isn't he? He's such an anomaly of existence. But I take it you want a serious answer.
Yes, I do.
Well, on Saturday I watched Batman Begins.
Sorry, you said... On Saturday. Brilliant.
Yo, it's me, Matt Whittle. They're not tripping, they're fine. Matt Hanks. Batman Begins. I really liked it. Well, I mean, I've always loved it, but I haven't seen it in a few years. And... when I think about it, I probably watch The Dark Knight once a year. I've seen Rises a few times fairly recently. When it was like the IMAX 10-year anniversary for Dark Knight, I saw it again in the cinema. So it still feels very fresh. Batman Begins, maybe. You know when you rinse something as a kid, you watch it so much that then you don't think to watch it every time something comes up, an opportunity where you can watch a film, and then suddenly you're like, oh shit, I probably haven't watched that film in like maybe 8 years. Mm-hmm. So it felt very fresh coming to watch it on Saturday. And it's what struck me about it is how comic booky it is and how much it's like basically a kung fu movie.
Yeah.
Because you just, when you think of Nolan Batman, you think of The Dark Knight, you think of like that kind of like heat aesthetic. And it's, the first one is nothing like that.
Yeah.
It's like him climbing up in the mountains, Uncharted style, you know, getting induced with fear toxins and these like crazy visuals. And he's more like a ninja. I feel like in 2 and 3, I mean, Christian Bale's still a fucking fantastic Batman, but he becomes a bit more kind of paramilitary, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Whereas in the first one, you know, he's got that kind of ninja feeling that Batman has, where you'll pop up out of the darkness, and you know that first scene where he comes up.
And it's shot from the perspective of the criminals.
Yes. So good. And it's like a fucking horror movie.
No, it is.
Fantastic. Also, I do like the later costume and the aesthetic choices they make, but in that first one, he just looks huge in that black suit. Like, he feels like he could take on a bear.
Yeah.
Whereas the armor they go for in the later ones, he looks a lot leaner, doesn't he?
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is not... It's not
it's tactile, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a different aesthetic.
I always think as well, when we're surprised with It Begins, is how much it feels like Gotham. Do you know what I mean? Like, well, how much it feels like you're in the world of Gotham. And not necessarily you don't feel that way in The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises, but there's something about, I don't know if it's the orange color grade of it or the way there's smoke on the streets or like it kind of feels a bit more
the narrow for me. I don't know why. Super comic book, yes, don't they? Yeah. It's just so strange knowing where it goes, because I feel like when you watch Batman Begins, if The Dark Knight had never been the direction they'd taken it, you could have totally had superpowers in the sequel, and you could have had like him meeting that Batman specifically meeting like
Killer Croc
or something. Yeah. Because it is still very heightened, and then they sort of strip it back in the second one. And then I think once they'd done that, they'd sort of made their bed.
Yeah,
so the third one, I think that's why the third one probably is the weakest, because it's sandwiched between the aesthetic of The Dark Knight, but then the League of Shadows come back, and you've got kind of all this mythos. Mm. I'm not sure if that's when the kind of the Nolanizing of Batman kind of breaks a little bit.
No, I know what you mean.
But yes, fantastic movie. Also, like, it does such a good job of getting into the mind of Bruce Wayne and seeing how fucked up he is, and how, like, you would just think this is a crazy person. And I love that scene where it kind of calls out the central kind of problem with Batman, in that, you know, yeah, his parents got shot, but he is still living 10 times better than most Gothamites, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he goes to Falcone and he's like, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not all this and that. And he's just like, well, you have so much to lose. I could kill your butler. I could kill Rachel Dawes. You know, you think you're coming in here like all selfish, like, oh, I don't have a care in the world. You do.
Yeah, I love that bit.
And secondly, when he's like, you know, like, look outside you, look outside this bar and see how people are dying and they're poor and they've got nothing. And you think because your mum and dad got shot, you've lived rough. Like, you have no idea. Yeah. Like, you've never tasted desperate. I think that's what he says to him. You've never tasted desperate.
Yeah.
You'd have to go 1,000 miles before anyone doesn't know your name. You know, so don't come here pretending like you've got the worst life ever. And I think that's such an interesting kind of trick shot for that character becoming Batman, because I would take away from that he actually does agree with him. And he's like, yeah, no, you know, I have lived better than a lot of other people have. That's why I need to go away on these travels and then come back and then commit my entire life to using these resources to helping people.
Yeah. Because he strips back his life and takes himself to a more basic place, you know.
He learns
this kung fu, essentially.
I think he understands the kind of the class politics of Batman, specifically that movie, better than maybe any other Batman movie.
They've all kind of been class-based movies as well, haven't they, really, when you think about it to some extent. Like, The Dark Knight is about sort of like, does certain action, you know, lawlessness, is it justified when someone else uses lawlessness and things like that. And I love that movie ends on a symbol of like, well, no, people need to believe in certain figures.
Yeah.
And I'm less important as a figure than believing in someone who just lived a life of decency and honesty in the public eye.
And the third one, they take the stock exchange, don't they?
Yeah.
But then that's kind of about how someone like Bane comes in and says to working people, you know, I'm just like you, I'm a freedom fighter. And it's like, really, that's not what they're about. They're using that kind of ideology to get what they want.
Yeah.
A fantastic trilogy overall, isn't it?
Oh yeah,
it really is.
And I don't think you'll ever see to some extent, by a Batman film like it. I think part of the problem is that now so many superhero films try and ape it, but I don't think you'll see a Batman film like it, just as in a sense of like, you will not see that level of craft and detail to that kind of Batman movie. Like, I hope about Matt Reeves' Batman that we get something completely different, because I'm fed up of superhero films thinking, well, let's go down the Dark Knight path. Because that film is so... That trilogy had such a perfect tone.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to replicate.
And it's Christopher Nolan. Like, at the end of the day, like, you need a director of that kind of caliber to make something like that. Do you know what I mean? And to have the freedom to make some bold choices like he does in terms of, like, the scale of things, like,
it's because it feels so director-led, that first movie, and then that's how they they meant to go on. Like, yeah. We saw Insomnia recently, didn't we, at the Prince Charles? And watching Batman Begins, like, not too long after, is like, you can so see this. This is from the director of Insomnia. This feels like his next movie. And I think that's what excites me the most about the Batman, is that I feel like they're taking it back to that time when Batman was just a cinematic franchise rather than a superhero franchise. You know, like, it feels like this is Matt Reeves' vision through and through. They're casting the best possible actors to fill these roles. I'm really excited for it.
I'm really excited.
You know what? It's been a while since The King has been back. And when they showed that test footage of him coming out of the shadows, I think it's going to be really good. Also, I recently bought the Return to Arkham, the box set on PS4.
Yeah.
So Arkham Asylum, Arkham City. I haven't played City in a long time, and I played like an hour of it yesterday, just like taking it out of the box. Like, oh yeah, I'll have a screw around with it. And I've been glued to it ever since.
It's one of the best games of all time.
Oh, so good. So good. And the thing I love about City is it just throws villain after villain after villain at you. But it all makes sense because essentially... Chris, do you know anything about the premise of...
No, nothing.
Oh, so City... You know Escape from New York, the Kurt Russell film?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it's literally Escape from New York in Gotham City, and they've cornered off a certain section of Gotham because the crime is getting so bad, they just corner it off and stuff all the criminals in there.
Oh my God.
So then, but then obviously they form their own kind of society in those walls, and then Batman has to go in for sort of a reason. You kind of find out as the plot kind of unravels. But yeah, basically every street corner, he's coming into contact with a different villain because they're all lumped in there. So it's a really kind of organic way to get his entire rogues gallery in one Batman game. And you face all of them. And it's not just like they pop up, like the bit I was playing earlier, Penguin's stolen Mr. Freeze's freeze gun and he's got him like held hostage. So you've got to go and talk to Mr. Freeze. And also, you're not fighting all the villains. You interact with them. So Mr. Freeze, he's got a common interest with you. So you're not actually fighting him. You do end up fighting him later on, but at that point in the game, you're just trying to break out his gear, and then he ends up just like, he comes out, he's in full suit, and you're just like walking around with him, talking to him, and like, so he's helping out of a crime scene. It's so cool. And Penguin, you end up catching him, and you end up getting this, it's so good. Penguin's like the funniest Batman villain. Like, he's shooting this ice gun, and you can't get past this bit until you go back and then get this like transponder, which disables the gun. So you go back and he's about to fire it at you and you just like have it like pressed in, and then Penguin starts going like, oh, this bloody thing isn't working. And then you go up to him and obviously he's like an eighth of your size. You're the Batman. You just like press square once and he just goes, boom. He just goes flying. And then after that, resurrects Solomon Grundy and you have this like epic boss battle.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's such a fun game, and I haven't played it in so long that I'm hyped to just blast back through it. And then I think I might go back to Asylum. I don't know why I picked City first.
Yeah.
But
that's what I love about Batman, what you were saying earlier, like about the cinematic like universe taking him out of that and making just an actual good movie, is, to me, we've said this before, he feels like James Bond in that sense where you could just keep making Batman movies like every other couple of
he's
years.
He's the most
like,
versatile superhero.
Superhero. He doesn't. I don't necessarily associate him with like... He is a superhero, yes, but like... Because he's so grounded and he is just a detective, essentially. I feel like you could do so many different iterations of him and so many different perspectives. There's so much content you can do.
You can have that campy Lego Batman, here's a suit for every occasion, water Batman, fire Batman, all this stuff. Yeah. I'm here with Robin, I'm going into space. And then you can also have like the weird gothic Burton version where all the characters are kind of like a bit twisted and, you know, like the Penguin in that version is... probably the darkest iteration we've ever had of the Penguin. And then you can have like the Arkham City version, which is like kind of, I'd say, the most faithful Batman adaptation from the comics.
Yeah.
Maybe next to like the animated series. Then you have like the Nolan version, where it's like, we're not going to do superpowers. Everything's going to be kind of, I hate to use the term grounded because I think it gets thrown around too much.
Yeah.
But you grounded know, in get, some yeah. sense yeah. of reality.
And then, I feel like with this Matt Reeves version, it could be like, well, my hope is that it's like The Long Halloween, where it's like this more detective route. And from everything I've heard about him saying, it sounds like from him listening to the Taxi Driver soundtrack while he's been writing it and stuff like that, I just feel like, and him saying it's more detective based, I just feel like that's a Batman we haven't really seen, have we? Like,
if they do go down the detective route and all of the villains are suspects, I hope they actually play it that the audience doesn't know who it's going to be.
Yeah.
Rather than it being like, oh, we know it's going to be the Riddler from the way the marketing's been played.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be cool if it was like literally like, who's it going to be?
Yeah.
And then we find out it's Chris Evans. Did you see anything, Chris?
This week? Nothing really, actually. No, nothing. There's nothing really caught my imagination this week, in all honesty.
Not even when I cooked that meal with an apron and nothing else.
Yeah, no, even that. If anything, that, you know, prompted me to write some, you know, so, it stimulated my creativity in a very different way.
Prompted you to gouge your eyes out. And Charlie, before we probably wrap things up in a little bow, have you seen anything interesting this week?
Yes, I've watched a couple of things. First of all, just to get out of the way, I watched A Dangerous Method, the Cronenberg movie with...
Oh, Fassbender.
With Fassbender and Viggo Mortensen and Natalie Portman.
Yeah, I didn't
even
watch
that. Keira Knightley. I'm saving it for this.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, no. Not particularly, you know, my favourite of Cronenberg. It's very different from Cronenberg stuff, but I also understand what interested him about it. He likes to deal with themes of not only just like violence and body horror, but he also likes to deal with themes of like sexuality and stuff, as we've seen with like Crash, for example. I don't know if you know,
or even like Videodrome.
Yeah,
he has a stomach vagina.
Yeah, it's fucked up. Do you know what the premise is at all, essentially, of Dangerous Method?
Is it got something to do with Freud?
Yeah.
So, okay, I don't know actually much else about it.
Yeah, so it's about Freud and Carl Jung's relationship with basically them going back and forth about their philosophies on things. And meanwhile, one of Carl Jung's patients is Keira Knightley, who essentially like suffers from like essentially like a some sort of like PTSD from the fact like abusive father sort of thing.
Right.
And basically Freud and Carl Jung work together to sort of cure her, essentially, and they debate on how to do that, essentially.
Yeah, okay.
But while this is happening, Carl Jung starts to sort of fall for her. But he already has like a wife and a child on the way. But it's kind of that Freud thing of like, she was beaten by her dad, and Fassbender, who's playing Carl Jung, sort of starts to beat her, and she starts getting sexually
aroused. But is he doing that as part of his experiment?
As experiment, because Freud believes that everything comes from like, everything in life and every issue comes from like a sexual problem. And Carl Jung tries to argue against that, and it kind of, he ends up kind of falling for his own. It's a weird movie. It's a very
Sounds
weird.
Really interesting.
It's interesting, but yeah. It's a lot of Freud sending letters to Carl Jung and them reading each other's letters out. And it's kind of like, as a movie, it's kind of weird. It's like, I get why it would attract
historically accurate, but
yes,
probably would have been more dramatic.
Yeah,
yes, kind of thing,
problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was kind of like, that's how I kind of felt with it. So it was an interesting watch. Not, you know, not a Cronenberg movie I'd say to run out. There's multiple others that I would suggest before that one. But, you know, it's an interesting watch, just put it that way.
Did you mean run out and see?
Yeah, why did I just say run out?
Oh, I'm just imagining, like, Dangerous Method. Ah!
I mean, I usually
No, I meant run out and see.
Yeah, yeah. I usually want to run out whenever I watch a fucking Cronenberg movie anyway. So they're fucking horrifying, but in the best, you know,
we've gone for a
compliment.
Few lately, haven't we?
We
Fly,
have.
Fly, Videodrome.
Yep.
Scanners, we went through, didn't we?
Scanners, yeah.
Oh, Shivers.
Shivers as well, yeah.
Fantastic movies.
I mean, they're all fucking horror-inducing.
He's
the wizard.
Absolutely.
He's one of my favourite filmmakers of all time. He's incredible.
Which shows your favourite Cronenberg, Chris?
Probably The Fly or Scanners. I can't really decide between the two.
The Fly is perfect.
I think The Fly is probably his greatest
movie.
Because it's got that warmth that I think sometimes can be missing from his movies. Even though I love all of them and they're all so interesting.
I agree.
There
can be a bit... not to say it lacks humanity, because it has humanity, but the characters feel a bit cold, like you said, sometimes.
Yes. Whereas I become so invested in Jeff Goldblum's character and his obsession and the romance that blossoms. You know, it's tragedy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a fucking tragedy.
We got ourselves a tragedy out of
here. Honestly. definitely. And also, finally caught up and finished BoJack Horseman.
Oh, yeah.
And I am obsessed with that show. And I didn't watch it with everyone else. I literally have just binged it in like a couple of weeks, maybe.
Yeah.
How long has it been? Like,
it's interesting seeing you go from, yeah, no, I'll probably get around to it, to like, oh, this might be in my top five shows time.
Yeah. It must be really weird for you guys, because obviously, like, you guys have been watching it as it's been on, and I've only just watched it now. And I sort of watched it a couple of times, the first couple of episodes.
Yeah.
And then I wasn't like blown away. I just sort of, it's one of those shows, like, I find that with a lot of TV shows where it takes a couple of episodes to you, for you to understand the characters, for you to really get invested, especially if they're very character driven like BoJack is.
It's hard, isn't it, though, when someone says to you, oh, give it a chance, it'll get better, because, like, you know, there's so much to watch already. Exactly. You kind of want something
I want it to be really good from the get-go.
It's very difficult, though, because not every show gets it right in the first episode.
But I think BoJack Horseman is well worth checking out, isn't it, if you haven't, if you've never seen it.
100%. There's things in it that it gets so real, and I think sometimes it only gets away with how dark it is through the fact that you're watching all these this colourful animation.
Oh yeah, well, that's the genius of it, isn't it?
Yeah, literally.
But also, at the same time, you forget you're watching a horse.
Yes.
I think that's its master stroke. You forget that the world is inherently silly.
Yeah, they're real people, but they're not. What's insane.
Are you happy with the way it ended?
I'm incredibly happy. I think it's the perfect ending. And that's why I said to you, I think, I'm not exaggerating, I think it's in one of my top five shows of all time.
I think I might put it up there, you know, as well. I'd have to have a proper thing. Chris, I wouldn't be surprised if it's not your favourite show ever, but definitely top five.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's in my top five yet, just from my top five's been pretty firm for so long. So do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's sort of like...
Oh, go on then, I'd like to hear, actually.
Well, my top five TV shows, probably Simpsons, Doctor Who, Peep Show, The Office UK, and 30 Rock is pretty firmly set.
Really? Interesting, yeah. they're all comedy shows.
Yeah, I'm not. You know, I'm not as big on, like, dramas. But
Doctor Who's not a comedy, Charlie. I'll tell you to refrain from
the one.
They're all very kind of. That's been so firmly fixed for so long. It would take.
But I've never seen you quite so obsessed with a show like BoJack Horseman.
Oh yeah. I mean, BoJack was. But do you know what I mean? Like, it's more about, for me, I can't really put it in top five yet because I was quite late to it. So this could just be wow at the time. Like, I think I'll end up revisiting it again and again and again. Do you know what I'm saying? But like, I think I'd be hesitant to place it in my top five shows purely out of I've not been watching it for that long.
I know what you mean.
You need time. I've watched every episode of Peep Show probably over 100 times. It's like I constantly rewatch it, and The Office the same. So it's so difficult.
It's weird because it depends how you like rate things, because there's some shows that I'll rewatch a million times. And I don't necessarily think that BoJack will be a show that I'll watch a million times, but it's more about how it made me feel when I was watching it. And the way it grabbed me and how it, I connected with certain things that, you know, I'm never going to have that again. Like, I might have it, rewatch it in a couple of years' time and be like, I remember that. But like, that there's something special about that. And when a show can make me feel that way, I mean, my favourite show of all time broke my fucking heart, which is The Wire in season 4. I won't ruin anything, but it's one of the, and I'd never felt more connected to and cared so much about these characters.
That's when you know a TV show is... Has really connected to you, with you when it ends and it feels like you've said goodbye, you've closed the door on fictional people.
No, literally, you're actually sad. Like, for a couple of days after, you're like almost depressed that you're not going to hang out with these people again, which is weird. No matter how nasty they are, or like, whether it's Heisenberg or if it's, you know, Avon Barksdale or, you know, or BoJack, you want to...
You said you call up your mates, don't you?
Yeah.
You're like, Matt, what are you up to today? I'm like, oh, I can't today, mate. Yeah, what are you doing? Nothing really. Just don't really want to see you.
Oh, in reality, it's like, please come on. I got a pizza at the back. I figured we would.
Chris, I can see from the tapping on your wrist that we are running out of time. So I'll wrap it up by saying, this has been the Full Fat Podcast. You've been Charlie Lee.
I have been Charlie Lee.
I've been Bruce Forsyth.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Burt Bacharach.
Should we plug our socials before we fuck off?
You can follow us on Twitter at Full Fat Videos. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/FullFatVideo. You can follow us on Instagram at full_fat_videos. And of course, on YouTube, it's youtube.com/FullFatVideos.
And you can get us on Letterboxd at FullFatVideos, which is moi, because I didn't think Chris was going to make one, not because I'm an egotist. And, and Chris is like, what, Chris Wizard?
Yeah, it's Chris Wizard.
Is that with a one instead of an I, or is that just Chris Wizard?
No, it's just Chris Wizard.
Chris Wizard. And Mr. Charlie Lilly.
Mr. Charlie. Well, if you'd like to hear more about the podcast, Your Favourite Film Was Awful, you can find us on Twitter at Faye Film Was Awful, Instagram Your Favourite Film Was Awful, and Facebook Your Favourite Film Was Awful, and also on YouTube Your Favourite Film Was Awful. So yeah, check the stuff out
and then you can get it on what podcast.
You can listen to us on all podcasting platforms, so Spotify, iTunes, you name it. We're on everything.
And so your favourite film is awful.
Your favourite film is awful.
I want to hammer that home for the lovely people out there.
And favourite is spelt the UK English way, not the American.
Can I just ask, has that ever come up as a problem?
I don't know. This is the thing. I don't know.
And did you consider that when you were making it?
Like, I did think about it. Yeah, I was like, oh, shit. Well, do we have to change the title? Because what would we do? Yeah, but I never... Well, we'll see how it goes.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
Should be fine, but...
I know you're British anyway.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, and I implore you guys all out there to check it out. Not least because I've been on it. yeah, should we close out with a bit of Kiss from Rose from Charlie Lilly? All right, okay, go on.
Ooh.